The following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show. It's the syndication math version here. It's Sunday, 7 a.m., and we're glad you were able to join us, and along with Mr. Dan Dubose, CPA. Dan, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Oh, okay. Very good. So as normal on Sunday, we're going to talk about REPs, real estate private partnership syndications, what they are, why you might want to invest in them, especially in this day of inflationary trends, and more importantly, how do we assess the math of individual specific transactions. We've got a couple transactions, both are smaller type transactions we're going to discuss today. We're seeing many opportunities in the what I would call the small apartment market, and even at the highest levels. One of the transactions we're going to look at today is actually out on CrowdStreet.com, which most of the transactions we've talked about in the past have been, several hundred unit type transactions. These are on the, or the one today on the CrowdStreet project is, what is that project, Dan? I think it's less
Tomball.
30. How many units was it?
No, I don't have the units in front of me, but it's a Tomball. I was getting ready to look it up to see.
Yeah, it's smaller, but we'll come back to that. I wanted to address, let's see, I just pulled it up here. Let me see just real quick. Well, you know what? I'm wrong. I was thinking it was small. I guess we looked at a couple. The one that we actually pulled appears to be several hundred units. But that said, man, what was I thinking? It was 30-something. Well, in any event, we'll deal with that momentarily. For those that may be new to the concept of real estate private partnership syndications, I wanted to talk just a bit about why, you know, with this private market investing trend that's really swept the country in many ways. And, you know, if you look at the history, there was a recent article in U.S. News and World Report that showed there were, in the year 2000, there were 8,000 publicly traded stocks, and today there's around 3,700. That's pretty significant. It's, 50% nearly decline in public investment options in just 20 years. Meanwhile, the private market asset space has grown 170% within the last decade. So with those facts in mind, I suggest you definitely see more than a little trend. People, for whatever reason, would prefer to put their money in options or alternatives to the publicly traded stock market. And these private market investments are 180 degrees the other way. There's very little liquidity, if any. These companies, when we say private market investing, these are investments that are made in the equity or providing debt in some way for companies that are not listed on a stock exchange. And, you know, these are companies that have not gone public, or at least as of yet. And, you know, since the value of the company in most cases is still germinating, I mean, it's still becoming more valuable as it increases the number of units that it holds. It gives the investor, I mean, here's the key for you, is it gives the investor the opportunity to realize outstanding gains from a trade sell, buyout, recapitalization, or potentially an IPO, although most of the investments that our clients focus on are individual partnerships that would never do an IPO, but you may be investing with a group under the same umbrella. Perhaps a syndicator gets to a point where they've got $1 billion or $2 billion in assets under management, and those scenarios where you could potentially see an IPO, although that's not why we invest. We invest for cash flow, typically current cash flow within the first several years, and you know, that's the focus. But that said, the way the SEC rules have developed in the recent past, it gives the opportunities for what I'm going to call normal people, the rest of us, to participate at a high level within a given apartment acquisition. And so it's almost like being an insider, if you will, if you were you know, working for or on the board, et cetera, of a public company. So you're going to generate gains theoretically that might come were you in an early stage investment with a publicly traded company. But that said, generally, you know, the real estate private syndication market, private partnership market, I think it's fair to say, and Dan, correct me if you disagree, but since, let's just say, since the debt malaise time, it actually is much longer than that, but let's that's in the recent past, where most of us remember the chaos that ensued, and especially in the stock market. But since 2008, the private partnership market has certainly experienced less volatility than the market in general. Wouldn't you suggest that's a true statement, Dan?
Here of late, that's very, for sure, very positive statement.
Well, here of late and back in 2008, 9, and 10, I mean, look at how many clients we have that invested in that time frame where, you know, you would, I guess you could call it the fog of war, that in spite of that, in spite of the debt market cratering, there were still deals done. And, you know, I know, when you listen to Self-Made Millionaire on his radio shows, he's talked about tripling his net worth in that time frame. And, you know, I would say in most cases, it's probably about half of what is represented there, as with other things that are said on the air from that group. But even then, it's pretty darn impressive, I would say. And I would say that since 2008, the best estimate I've seen is net returns. Now, this is average. And what do I say about averages, Dan? Are we average?
Well, no, we're regular.
That's right. We're all actual, is what it amounts to. But anyway, the average net return over the last, 13, 14 years has been about 14%, and it's definitely outpaced most of the public market equivalents. And then you could go back, you know, the U.S. Private Equity Index shows a 10.48%. 20-year return, while the S&P 500 managed 5.9%, about half over those same two decades. So this is what's causing more people. I'm sure you probably work with people. You may have relatives that have taken the move out of the public traded markets into things that you can see, touch, feel. You know who you're investing with. You know who the lead partner is. You can go walk that property. You can go to meetings with your or attend webinars with your other investors in transactions. You might join one of the old school member mentor platforms. You know, there's several of those in here in the city of Houston, and you know, that's another way to become exposed to the education, to specific transactions that are available, to where you learn how to invest your money with a group of people to go take down a 200-300 maybe a 700 unit project, as we've done recently. Personally, I invested in one back in April, and here in Houston, which is an amazing opportunity in terms of the asset quality that you might have not otherwise had a chance to invest in were it not for the way that the SEC's crowdfunding rules have trended over the last, since 2008 or so. So about the same time frame. There are differences, though, in the way that these transactions are undertaken. Some would argue that the primary difference, and I will tell you, I agree with this, is liquidity. That's probably the single biggest difference in the way we value investments. And, you know, investing in a privately held company comes with, even today, I mean, it's as fully developed as it is, it certainly has more restrictions than investing in public companies. Dan, what would some of those restrictions be that might apply to a real estate partnership versus trading stocks, bonds, et cetera?
Are you talking about liquidity?
Well, that's the big one. What else do we have when you invest your money in a private partnership taking down a 200 or 300 unit apartment building versus Apple stock? Say again?
Discount?
Well, I'm focused on the risk factors. Yes, we do get discounts for these risk factors. If we're valuing, for instance, for a Roth conversion, to undertake a Roth conversion, we like those discounts. We don't think the risks are as great as the SEC would want you to think. They want to make sure you've been warned that, you know, you're going to have no voting control, you're relying on a small team to execute the business plan, you may not be able to rent the units, you may not be able to refinance those units. What else is there, Dan? May not be able to sell them. Can you think of other issues that the SEC warns us about or makes the attorneys that write the private placement memorandums warn us? Have any of those in your memory bank?
I do, but I can't pull them out.
Not at 7 a.m. in the morning, huh? Well, essentially, the risk of execution is the big one, and yet I would argue you've got that with any publicly traded company you'd like to examine, and you've also got other issues that we don't typically face with apartments. There's a more consistent earnings trail is what I would argue. I mean, how many times do you see the company's stock values, you know, it's a yin and a yang, I guess you might say, or a yo-yo effect every time there's a bit of news that rattles the markets. And I get a kick out of some of the things that caused that. And in fact, I've seen situations where the earnings went up, and many times actually, and the stock price went down. I've never understood, generally, I don't understand what causes that. There's obviously exceptions where I guess you could look at it and say, well, you know, their earnings went up for some reason, but maybe that puts a damper on demand or inventory, you know, for the next quarter. It's not their earnings going up, but maybe the way they were able to raise their earnings. So I guess there are explanations. But, you know, with an apartment building, as your net operating income goes up, I don't think I can think of a project I've ever seen where your value of your assets, your buildings, has gone down. Can you think of that, Dan? I don't know that I've ever seen that.
No, that's one of the things you strive for, of course, to, in your apartment management, is to get your net operating income up so you can get your value up. So, you know, either at a sale or a refinance, you've got that higher value to fund it, to help back it up,
that's
and make sure it's there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So as the income goes up, that increases the loan-to-value ratio that you might be able to get from a lender. Admittedly, loan-to-value numbers now are down a bit from what we're used to. I think we're seeing 65% would probably be the sweet spot. There's some that are higher. I don't know that I've seen maybe a couple 60% deals, but that's an issue in terms of hitting the numbers. It puts a more of an emphasis on underwriting, making sure you understand the numbers that are associated with any given project, which is what we try to help our clients with, is we want to make sure that you understand what you're signing up for when you invest in these private market opportunities. You know, it's interesting, too, when you look at the dollar value of the capital that's poured into this asset space, how it's not just the investor that's getting access to, you know, interesting and more profitable, typically more profitable assets to invest in, but the access to the private market grants, you know, younger, smaller, newer companies the ability to realize larger gains than they might access otherwise. You know, if they were borrowing 100% from a bank, the ability to raise capital of, you know, 20 to 30% for a project is pretty significant when you look at what those companies' choices might be otherwise to undertake these transactions. In terms of, you know, I mentioned some of the investment risk earlier. I was also going to say, you know, it can take a while. I forgot to mention that one. The time frame that you might get a return on your money. I know I've seen transactions as of late that tell you right up front that, you know, this is a 5-year plan before you're going to get your money back. And in some cases, no interim cash flow will occur from operations or a refinance. And so that's kind of at the one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum is, and I haven't seen any deals lately, but in the recent past, there have been transactions that start paying distributions in quarter one. And I don't know what you think about that, Dan. I've never been a fan of those transactions because that typically means you're starting to get some of your own money back as opposed to some of the fruits of the implementation of the changes, the renovations that you're putting in place to raise rents. How can that have happened in the first quarter, right? And so what that generally means in my mind is that the syndicator has overraised, which I think is an egregious scenario at best, where, you know, they're handing you some of your money back. And it's like, well, you know, if you're going to take more money than you really need to execute the operating plan of rehab and you know, releasing units, trying to do a changeover, I would rather keep my money and invest it in something else, maybe the excess. And so I've never been a fan. I've had clients that said, oh, well, you know, we're getting our money back starting, you know, into the first quarter. It's like, well, yeah, you and the syndicator's team are going to be taking their share, the part that we refer to as the promote or the override in many cases. Now, truthfully, some of the better transactions we're seeing now are putting a preferential distribution in for the passive investor, which we think is certainly something that can offset some of the risk, is if we get our money back, at least our initial capital, before the syndicator starts taking the big promote that they're often getting. I mean, we're seeing 70-30 splits now pretty routinely, and in many cases, in fact, the transaction we're going to look at here today has a scale where once you hit a hurdle rate of 20% internal rate of return thereafter, which is pretty stout, by the way, thereafter the cash flows get shared 50-50. So you know, it's an interesting time, I guess you might say. And by the way, one of the other risks that I should mention is that distributions, and this may surprise some people, but when you're a passive partner in these transactions, it's kind of like, I remember back in the day, George Steinbrenner, you may remember, Dan, was the general partner of the New York Yankees. And there was an expression that was repeated often around the business world, is that Steinbrenner was the epitome of the sole discretion term that you see in many business partnership agreements, et cetera. He made it very clear that if you were going to invest in the Yankees as a limited partner, you wouldn't be allowed in the kitchen. You know, can't have too many chefs in the kitchen. Right, Dan?
That's right. You know, you were talking about getting your money back in the first quarter. That's kind of like getting excited when the IRS sends you a check back at the end of the year, you know, just because you're paid in too much money.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't thought of that. That's a very good analogy. And, you know, if you're one of those folks that thinks, oh, you know, I did a great job on you know, paying in enough taxes here, if you're getting more than a few dollars back, let me thank you, first of all, for helping fund the government for free, because you won't get any interest on that money, assuming it gets paid back. I think it's still a six-week time limit for the IRS has to pay you. Is that the case, Dan? That hadn't changed, has it?
You know, they've been really good when you file correctly and file on time and file electronically. They're getting them back within 2 weeks. We're seeing now, but that's
I was going to say electronic filing is kind of the key there. Although it's interesting, they seem to come up with questions that delay some refunds. I know we're still trying to find refunds from last October that were e-filed. You know, the returns were. It's crazy. You know, but anyway, distributions in these transactions are made at the sole discretion of the sponsor or the syndicator or lead partner, whatever you want to call them. And, you know, I at times I have clients, or I've seen clients, that kind of get used to this asset space. At least for a while, they were getting distributions every quarter, and came to think of it kind of like, you know, I forget who pays dividends and who doesn't pay dividends in the stock market. It's not my cup of tea. I don't invest in the market, but, you know, it's not quite the same as getting a dividend, a quarterly dividend that I think, you know, companies like AT&T have made for most of our lives. And it's, you know, it's based on there being operational cash flow. So, you know, the reason you get distributions out of a real estate partnership is because the rents exceed the expenses for the given period, and the syndicator or the sponsor decides that, okay, we've got enough excess cash on hand, we're going to make a distribution. And so it's a little bit different than buying a public company where you know you're buying a dividend. And yet, you know, there's also the prospect of that property going up in value significantly from the point you acquire it to the point that you sell it as the partnership. And I don't know of many public stocks that when you buy them, you might double your money in 3.5-4 years, which is kind of the target that we set on most of the transactions that we advise our clients on. Let me see if there's anything else I wanted to mention. I think I was down to the end of my list on why we invest in these or this asset class. And, you know, I can't stress enough how all of this is a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, these transactions historically were off limits to the smaller investor. And again, due to the crowdfunding rules, which I believe, Dan, if I'm not mistaken, the first rev or the first version of the crowdfunding rules came out, what, around 2008? It was during the Obama administration. And, you know, it created opportunities. And by the way, the word crowdfunding is the word that you probably no doubt have heard that applies to that law. I believe it was Regulation A. I think they called it that at that time. They do now. And in any event, you know, it's gotten better. I mean, it seems like the SEC has continued to relax certain of the rules and, you know, allow more normal people, not the millionaire class necessarily, although a lot of millionaires do invest here. Private equity has swarmed into this space, not just this space, also single family. But in any event, we're happy. We're pleased that we have these options now. And anyway, Dan, let's turn our attention to the transaction that's out on CrowdStreet. And, you know, I don't know why I was still thinking, and maybe it is a smaller transaction. I was just scrolling the snapshot here. But in any event, this property is located out in Tomball. It's being purchased. The overall budget is $203,000 a unit, which if you think about Class A type housing in this day and time, where you've got significant, well, I guess we still have significant supply chain issues. I guess some products are coming down, at least building materials wise, while others, labor sure isn't coming down. But in any event, that's a pretty decent price all in if that's truly Class A, which is what it's represented. You know, the guys that are doing this deal's positioned it to be completed at a very favorable cost basis compared to other Class A luxury properties in the suburban markets of Houston. I'll say, I mean, that's what, Dan, about $100,000 under what we're seeing in other new construction, higher outside of Houston. And and I guess they start with having gotten the prime site, the acreage, at what they claim to be a considerable discount of about $8,000 or $8,500 a unit. I don't know. I'm not familiar with the exact spot that this thing is in, but I know Tomball in general has gotten more expensive over the years, right? It's become kind of a second hub or third hub. I guess when you look at the bands that go around the city of Houston, Tomball's almost become indistinguishable. You know, if you drive 99 around, it's amazing how that whole area from 59 all the way over to I-10 has exploded. But in any event, the sponsor, as most of the CrowdStreet sponsors are, tend to be multiple finishers when it comes to getting to the finish line. You know, good experience. This group has completed numerous projects across the Sun Belt states, and they're going to be replicating what they've done elsewhere in Houston. And, you know, they're also a Houston-based company. which, you know, these days isn't nearly as critical, although we like to see it. But in any event, you know, if you're familiar with the lay of the land, so to speak, it can only help you. So dealing with permitting, you know, having established construction crews, subcontractors, et cetera. And they claim, and I don't know if they hit their mark, but they were going to have final permits out here just by the end of September. We just passed it, so I'm not sure if they hit that. But in any event, you know, we think this has the looks of a decent project. Speaking of, I guess we should mention some of the math just at a high level. The targeted investor internal rate of return we mentioned earlier is 20%. That's at or above the level that we would normally seek. Of course, what do we say about IRRs, Dan, with respect to timing specifically?
As the cash flows, the IRR is determined. Of course, you know, the get cash earlier, the higher your internal rate of return, IRR could be. This one's
That's
showing
true.
Up rather high, 20% over on a three-year period, you know, 20%
and
over
that's,
3 years.
I was just going to say, the whole period being 3 years is part and parcel of the reason. So assuming that they hit the three-year mark and they're able to sell this property, this IRR is certainly within their reach. Did you notice what the targeted equity multiple is, the EMX, as we call it, Dan?
Yeah,
1.7. I'll help you on that one. 1.7, which is pretty close to that magic number that we utilize of 0.463. Let's see here. Well, actually, it's right on it. So that's a good thing. Assuming, again, they're able to turn this thing and actually exit the investment in 3 years. And the IRR is the partner level IRR, which is good that they explain that. The higher number, 24.7% targeted internal rate of return, is at the what we call the project level, which means there's some other hands in the till, so to speak, before the money gets down to the partners. And that's you know, that's an issue that you really need to watch out for on any private partnership memorandums, private placement memorandums you might be looking at, is are the numbers reflecting the project level or are they reflecting the investor level? Big difference in many cases. And so, you know, don't get all excited when you see some of these numbers until you confirm that, you know, you're talking about what the passive investor is going to get, right? Not just what the partnership is going to get. And I remember here a while back, we had a transaction that was getting ready to undertake that the lead partner had done one of his recent sales, quote unquote, which he plays a little loose with the word recent. These were like three-year-old dispositions, but okay, we'll go with that. And he showed a 900% overall return on a transaction, and that was, without saying it, it was to the project. It wasn't to the partners. And if you ask, well, how much went to the partners? Well, it was a significantly lower number, and by the time you figured out also the current fee burden that this syndicator was applying to new transactions versus what it was 10 years earlier or 8 years earlier when he started the aforementioned, quote, case study property, there's no way, if you layered on the current fee structure, that transaction would have seen anywhere near the rate of return that they were trying to show that they were capable of. And a little bit disingenuous, I would argue. So anytime you compare historical returns make sure that the fee burden, make sure that a lot of things are copacetic. You know, the location where the property was, the submarket it's in. You know, all these things have a big impact on whether you're going to hit the targeted math. And in many cases, you're starting off in a position where there's just no way with the assorted details. Dan, let's talk a little bit further. You know, 3 years isn't a lot of time to execute on a transaction. So business plan wise, I wanted to just talk a moment. This project is 2.5 miles south of Grand Parkway. That's Texas 99. And, you know, it's obviously a rapidly expanding suburb, 12-acre parcel of land. They've executed the MUD district reimbursement agreement. So, you know, that's progress if you've ever been involved in getting one of those done. And, you know, they've got an in-house general contractor that oversees all of their construction and projects. And I think that that's significant in this day and time when you've got issues with labor, et cetera. And presumably an in-house general contractor will serve your interests perhaps better than somebody that's out there, you know, trying to work on multiple or serve multiple clients as they're building these units. In any event, they seem to think, and this is kind of key, that their current projections based on a previous deal, but they believe that they can essentially build 230 units in 10 months with stabilization. And I assume they're talking about building and actually having tenants. That's what stabilization would typically mean. That seems pretty aggressive. But in any event, they did a transaction in Bel Air that similar market atmosphere, is what they're basing this on, and they leased up 25% of the units per month. So that's pretty incredible. And I would assume that's obviously not from month one. I don't see they believe that proposed initial occupancy starts at the 14-month mark and full completion of all buildings by month 18. That's still pretty aggressive, don't you think, Dan? Having built some apartments in your past, not your recent past, but in your past, that's a pretty quick scenario for 230 units.
That's a quick build if everything goes perfectly, I think. But, you know, I had a guy tell me a long time ago, he said, you got to make something happen on every unit every day. And part of that, you know, you work from your ground up, so you're going to have something happening on your unit every day if you've got everything working like it should, like a clock. So 18 months is a strong build period, I think, for 230 units, you know, with lumber being what it is.
Well, better to be out in Tomball than in Bel Air, I would suggest, if you're going to pull that off.
Leasing in Tomball is probably going to be a little slower than leasing in Bel Air, too, I would imagine.
Leasing will be slower or building will be slower?
Leasing. When they've got it, finally got that first unit, that first building available, you know, to rent or to lease, I would think Tomball is going to be a little bit less of a market than Bel Air.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not familiar with the current goings on in that submarket, but I know generally it's exploded from an employment and other standpoint. But I was thinking that, you know, getting permits would be slower. I think it'll be faster out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. My goodness, you know, yeah. The city of Houston is notably slower to provide the permitting. But in any event, Let's see. This, you know, if you look at what they're putting in this property, I mean, it's the classic Schedule A, or I'm sorry, Class A mix of amenities, you know, a fitness center, a club room, an internet cafe, yoga and spin rooms, media rooms, got the Bark Park, or Dog Park, as they call it. Grills, outdoor kitchens, resort-style pool. I mean, this, a resort-style pool, this is every bit as nice, it looks like, as, say, a Camden or a Hanover-type property, you know, down inside the Loop, right?
And, yeah, it looks like it's got a great look to it, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, talking about population growth, more than 80%, they say here, over the last decade of the population growth of Harris County has occurred in the unincorporated parts of Harris County, which includes the northwest suburb market. I don't know how much of that. I know Fort Bend has had significant growth, and I know Montgomery County has as well. But I do agree that, you know, the big difference is you've got a State Highway 99 now that sure does increase access to, you know, employers like ExxonMobil, Hewlett-Packard, Dakin, you know, all are less than 20 miles from the site, which I guess in Houston that means it's nearby, right, Dan?
Yeah, you know, but, you got 249, it runs right through there too, and that's another major thoroughfare, a major.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, Camden, speaking of Camden, they are in the general area. I noticed looking at the map, there, Camden North Point is up that away. I'm not sure, trying to figure out, but looking at this, just how close or how far north that is of, okay, so that's well past Lakewood State, so that's not quite to, well, it's nowhere near 99, but it's not, you know, 5 miles away, probably, would be my guess. So that's a good indication. If you can get the kind of rents that Camden charges, I think that's definitely a positive. Looking at, let's see, I was going to mention, oh, more about the sponsor. So, vertically integrated, prominent construction company, focuses multifamily. They've, since 2005, have been involved in a wide variety of projects, totaling in excess of 8,000 Class A multifamily units and more than $1.5 billion in total investment. This is not a lightweight. And, you know, I often refer to the fact that CrowdStreet, if you're accredited, and by that I guess we should deviate a moment. And by the way, for those of you that have just maybe come on the air since we started the show today, I'm got my associate Dan Dubose, CPA, on the show today as usual, and we're discussing real estate private partnership syndications. A specific project is a project that's getting ready to kick off in the Tomball area, and you know, I oftentimes forget that people come on the air at different points in the hour and they're not really sure what we're talking about. But anyway, if you've got any questions about your specific facts and circumstances and how you might get started in the real estate private partnership market, feel free to either text us at 713-581-0195, or you can leave a voicemail if you prefer to talk the message out, or send an email to info@npross.com. That's alphabetically November Papa Roger Oscar Singapore Singapore .com. But in any event, you know, the metrics that look good on this project are, of course, the equity multiple, just to kind of summarize things. and the internal rate of return. And, of course, you know, for those that are just dipping their toe in the pond, a minimum level of investment in the $25,000 range. That's, you know, I guess the lowest hurdle we typically see in these transactions. And I did mention that it is a 506C transaction, which means you've got to be accredited. And for the moment, let's define that quickly. If you have at least $1 million net worth, not counting the equity in your home, you're qualified as an accredited investor. Or if you earn, as a single person, $200,000 a year for the past 3 years, with the likelihood that it'll continue, or if you're married filing joint, if as a couple you earn $300,000 for the last 3 years with the expectation of it continuing, then you're accredited. And the difference in this asset space is that the SEC, who defines accredited and non-accredited, and they define the rules for 506B versus 506C offerings. 506B is one that non-accrediteds can invest in up to 35. And then an unlimited number of accredited investors can join, whereas 506C transactions are restricted to accredited only. And the 506C transactions, notably, can advertise or generally solicit investors. That's why we can talk about some of these details on the air. If this were a 506B transaction, we wouldn't be able to do that. We could talk about generally the type of projects that a syndicator or sponsor may take on, but we can't talk about specific investments. So typically when you hear us dissect some of these transactions, we'll be referring to 506C because we can be more specific and perhaps give a lot more information that might be of interest to somebody that's thinking about getting started. Dan, we've only got about 5 minutes left. Did you want to pivot real quick and talk about the, talk about a 506B transaction? We don't really want to talk about many details, but there is what looks to be a reasonably good transaction that you do have to be a member of a local real estate platforms, investor platforms, old school. I refer to them as travel agents because you don't need to buy a membership to invest in this asset space anymore, although there may be reasons that you choose to. But I would tell you that there's a lot to understand behind the scenes of any of these investment platforms. And if you don't know some of the details, you may be surprised to learn the realities of some of the details involved in being members. You might see some real conflicts of interest on these platforms in terms of what you're being told versus what the powers that be are doing. In fact, the largest platform, Self-Made Millionaires platform in Houston, the most prolific investor and mentor of that group, been a member of that organization long before, or I guess it was just after I became a member. I joined back in 2003 to learn about multifamily. I'm going to say it was an experience, not always good, but, you know, hey, you take the good with the bad. And I'll give kudos to Self-Made Millionaire for opening my eyes to the prospects. But anyway, so a huge conflict of interest exists, and that most prolific investor slash mentor is actually syndicating out on one of the major platforms, which in addition to CrowdStreet.com, RealtyMogul.com is one of the top shelf groups. And you might be surprised to learn that if you're accredited, you can invest with that gentleman's projects when you couldn't within the confines of the membership platform. It's rather telling that, you know, at the same time they're selling you a $20,000 membership, they know that their leading mentor, oldest, longest, best mentor, and he's quite an experienced real estate investor. I think a lot of him, but I also think it's rather unusual that he would be leading projects out there and charging all the horrible fees that you'll hear about when you join this platform, about how they never would allow those fees to be charged on the offerings on their platform. And yet, you know, the same thing that everybody else is doing that they rail upon as being immoral or unrighteous, etc., he's doing outside. And I guess all I'm going to say is be consistent. Whatever you talk about, please don't make us find out, and don't make us have, you know, as a member, if I were a member still, these conflicts of interest. It doesn't look good. And it doesn't make you appear credible when you're saying one thing and doing another. Dan, I think we'll pick up the transaction that I mentioned perhaps next week, since we're right up against the end of the show. I want to just say quickly that for anyone that wants to consider working with us, if you don't have existing professional advisors, which we always believe you should check with before you execute these transactions, or you execute any tax advice we may give, always seek the counsel of your existing accountants, lawyers, registered investment advisors, real estate mentors, etc. And for those of you that are still thinking about single family, I'm going to suggest that that you should focus on multifamily if you have the minimal amounts of, say, $50,000 to $100,000 to invest. I think it's a lower hanging fruit, and it gives you the ability to ride the coattails of somebody that's already been there, done that, and you know, further, it allows you to not have to get out of bed every morning to go run those old apartment buildings, which is generally what we're buying to fix up. Dan, thanks for joining once again. Did you have anything to add as we sign off here?
Yeah, I was just going to say that one small property that we were mentioning here briefly has got an 8.25% interest rate, which is really amazingly high, I think, right now. Not surprising that it's going up. That's just something we're going to be looking at going forward, I believe.
Yeah, well, let me guess, it's probably fixed, though, right? I hope.
Yeah, fixed, but it's 3 years. Yeah. You know, it's scary, yeah, what's happening with that interest rate, driving the market, the public market as well.
Yeah, that's a good
interest
point.
Interest rates are,
well,
very
listen,
effective.
Yeah, we'll be back this coming Saturday to discuss more tax math. And if you have a chance to join us, we would welcome being able to discuss those topics for you. Thank you for listening this week.
Thanks for listening to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Be sure to tune in next Saturday at 5 for another edition of Be a Planner Show here on AM 700 KSEB.